You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today's guest is Freddy Silva. Freddy Silva is one of the world's leading researchers of ancient systems of knowledge, crop circles, and the interaction between temples and consciousness. He is also the best-selling author of Secrets in the Fields and producer of the DVDs Stairways to Heaven, The Practical Magic of Sacred Space and Temple Making. He has appeared on numerous television programs, documentaries, and radio shows. He'll also be at the UFO conference at the ARE in Virginia Beach from November 12th to the 14th. Well, thanks for coming on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, you wrote a book called Commonwealth, Our Legacy of Places of Power and the Transfiguration of the Human Soul. Could you tell us about it?
Yes, it was sort of following on from my first book, which was a huge exploration on the phenomenon of crop circles, and it led me to the understanding that the crop circles were appearing in 29 countries around the world, and whenever they appeared, it was always next to ancient sacred sites. And indeed, they actually follow the same principles of temple building that have been going on for thousands of years. This is the manipulation of magnetism, the use of geometry, certain forms of potentized water, and so forth. And it sort of got me thinking about the whole sort of process backwards. What was the purpose behind creating temples in the first place? And I've sort of been visiting temples around the world for the past 15 years. And after a while, these places have a sort of effect on you. They begin to talk back to you as if they're living, breathing organisms. And I was looking through all my notes, and I realized that I'd suddenly inherited this huge volume of information, which really looked at temples as not just places where the laws of physics are slightly altered, but also that these places were built as a insurance policy by people from a long, long time ago who had the foresight to see that humanity would end up in the state that it's in today. And they built these places of power where people are allowed to go in and literally just have their soul transfigured. They are by the process of, you know, working with magnetism or the geometry and the way the stones are all put together and aligned. There are certain physiological and psychological effects that take place inside these places, and this is the legacy that we've inherited, that we suddenly have these places around the world where we can go and find out that we too are gods, just like it is inscribed in many of the temple walls around the world.
Well, you talk about sacred sites. How do you define a sacred site?
It's just in pretty much in the same way that the ancient Egyptians defined it. They originally were talking about, and this is really sort of going back to the Edfu building texts that were deciphered by this incredible woman in England called Eve Raymond, who wrote an incredible book on the transcription of the Edfu building texts and the pyramid texts. And they talked about how there's a differentiation between profane space and sacred space, and how before a cataclysm wiped out the former world of the gods, and this was the great flood of 9700 BC, which has now been very accurately dated, they talked about a way in which there was this previous civilization here on Earth who were sort of slightly different from us, and they were considered to have complete mastery of the laws of physics, and they were able to define certain spots on the land which were just magnetically much more enhanced. Now, the Aborigines know all about this. The Native American cultures know about this. They're able to perceive these very special spots on the land just by observing nature, and also animals have a propensity to also locate these spots. And so I guess over time what happened was that they found that at these very unusual nodes of energy that your states of awareness are much more open to receiving information, visions, and other levels of reality. So the ancient Egyptians were talking about the primordial mounds of the gods, which were secured by a type of potentized water. And then when they had actually potentized the water around these primordial mounds, they set up what they describe as anchoring the serpents and also removing the enemy snake, which is a metaphor, of course, for the magnetic lines of energy which swirl across the landscape. So they were able to anchor something to a specific spot. It seems that they had complete control over the laws of nature. And then from there, the followers of these ancient gods said that they would build the mansions in the image of the former gods, where people could actually go in and be transformed into gods and into bright stars. So there is a certain amount of science that's actually behind this, because even the Russians who were looking at Gothic cathedrals and ancient temples back in the 50s and the 60s, they discovered that when you actually go into these places in a state of veneration, they monitored people's brainwave patterns and found that your ability to be telepathic goes up 4,000% above normal waking state. So it's very clear that these places have a very profound effect on the human body and its way of perceiving things.
When you visit these places, how do you feel?
Oh, very different. Mm-hmm. I should point out that you have to sort of, it's like a good relationship. You have to meet it halfway. I always joke that the skeptics will never understand this, simply because they go in with a certain preconceived view, and of course that's putting up a certain barrier to actually accepting that something might happen. And it's you know, that sort of thing sets up a physical state. As we all know, your intent and your brainwaves have electromagnetic frequencies. Even at a party, for example, people know that when someone's in the room and they don't want to talk to anybody, you're setting up that force field around you. And I think it's the same way with sacred space as well, that you go in with a certain thing in mind. And if you go there just to sort of with an open state and willing to interact, the building sort of starts to interact with you, and the first time you go to a pyramid or a stone circle or Stonehenge, it's as if you sort of take a look around you and you perceive the physical objects. You're very much aware of the physicality of things, the size and the scale of things. And you go home and you go, well, that was interesting, and, you know, and but you feel that there's something that's touched you. You're not quite sure what it is. So you go back the second and the third and the fourth times, and each time the place opens up just a little bit more to you. And having done this hundreds of times around the world, actually hear the side talking back to you and giving me information, and then I'll make notes, and I'll just spend a few months researching these notes, these little images that I've been given. I'll give you a case in point. I was in New Zealand a couple of years ago on my first trip to what has to be one of the most powerful sacred sites in the Southern Hemisphere. And this is a natural temple that was laid down, again, from many, many millennia ago. And the legends talk about a mythical race of people who are very, very tall, fair-skinned, reddish, who came from a sinking land somewhere in the Pacific. And these myths, of course, occur around the world. And I just stayed for the third time at this wonderful environment, and I kept being told, you know, to find out what lies opposite. And at the time, I was sort of thinking about the connection between Celtic mythology and native and New Zealand mythology, because they're so similar. And so I wrote this down. I thought, I wonder what this sort of lying opposite is all about. And I had this vision that there was some connection to some place on the opposite side of the world to this site in New Zealand. So I got back home, came back to Maine. So I got addicted to this interesting little program called Google Earth, which is highly accurate, and I did a plot course, basically a ley line, a straight line from New Zealand, and find out where its opposite would be on the Northern Hemisphere, and it literally sits right outside the sacred site of Santiago de Compostela, which is a pre-Celtic sacred area where the Neolithic people used to worship the stars. Very much like in the south of New Zealand as well. And I thought, well, that was an interesting correlation. And then what I did was, literally, I sort of connected the dots on the line all the way from New Zealand all the way to Santiago de Compostela, and found, to my amazement, that it goes through some incredible places on Earth and some old places. It goes right through the heart of the temple of Borobudur in Java. I mean, literally through the center of it. A number of old temples in India which go back to prehistoric times. It just bypasses Mount Ararat, and then it goes through southern Italy, through France, through some very, very old churches, and the journey's pretty much over land. Now, in the esoteric world, it's all about the balance opposite, so I figured what would happen if I reconnected this line way back from Spain back to New Zealand. Well, the return journey goes mostly over water, not land, And the only landmass that it goes through in the whole of the Atlantic is actually the islands of the Azores and the mist surrounding the drowned land of Atlantis. And as it turns out, the actual line goes right through a crater, the most active crater on the island. It's a tiny little town called the Seven Cities on the island of San Miguel, which is named for the Archangel Michael. And legend has it that the town called Seven Cities is named after the fabled Seven Cities of Atlantis. So I thought the connection was quite astonishing, and even more so when the line then proceeds all the way across the tip of Southern America, barely touches Colombia, and then it goes right through the Pacific Ocean. And again, the only landmass that I'm on the way back to New Zealand is Easter Island, and of course we all know what's there. So when you think about this connection that was sort of given to me as a vision in my mind when I was sitting at a sacred site, and what came through it and what has been discovered as a result of that, it shows you that you give these places to talk to you and feed you some information that was probably put down on Earth for thousands of years ago.
You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Freddie Silva.
A lot of these texts and wall inscriptions in the temples do describe these places as cities of knowledge. It goes all the way to the Tamil culture, which preceded the Great Flood. In fact, there are records that appear to go back at least to 15,000 BC. And talk about the cities of the gods, which were also cities of knowledge. And it was around these cities of knowledge that our ancient civilizations grew. There was always a navel of the earth, what would be a standing stone that looked like a big phallic symbol in the middle of nowhere. And it was around these supposed navels of the earth that entire towns and cities and civilizations grew and still are today. So perhaps there's more to the myths than meets the eye, because it's not just a fact that you go to these places to have a certain interchange with the numinous quality of the site. It's the fact that the information is also encoded in the fabric of the building themselves, and also you receive the information in terms of acquired knowledge through your meditative interaction with the site, which, of course, the Russians and also the engineers at Princeton University have found. There is an energy of the site which actually does interact with people and heightens their perception and then also their consciousness when they walk in there.
Well, what do you think of Göbekli Tepe, that 11,900-year-old site in Turkey?
Oh, it is a sacred site all by itself. It's combination of about 18 different stone circles, and I'm sure they're going to find a lot more. Mm-hmm. In fact, I wrote about that in my book, began to touch on it. It's only a few hundred miles, I think it's about 90 miles from the actual resting place of Nizark, which was discovered about three decades ago. But it was mentioned all the way back into 300 BC by famous historians, including Josephus. So, in fact, he was joking that even back in 300 BC, people go from all around the world to actually pick up souvenirs and part of the ship. We know it's not a figment of the imagination. And it's interesting that when the flood came in 9703 BC, and the accounts are very unanimous around the world, I mean, there are 500 flood myths, all of which synchronize with each other, despite the fact that these cultures had allegedly no contact with one another. So a geological record does show that around the time of 9700 BC, there were seven fragments of comet that did strike the Earth at strategic locations, which would have created an incredible array of tidal waves, which that people have even been found on the tops of mountains in France and Swinmont, 1,700 feet above sea level, and the bones of human remains have been found there, mixed with mammals and other animals which were extinct after that catastrophe. And yet, only a few hundred years after that catastrophe, we see Göbekli Tepe being set up. I don't believe that Göbekli Tepe may be actually a lot older, may actually precede the flood. And this comes from the new evidence that the sites were deliberately buried, and very carefully so. In which case, it makes the site a pre-diluvial temple, and again, makes it, confines it into the world of the cities of the gods. because if someone went to a lot of trouble to build those stones, and some of those stones are over 18 feet tall, you can see quite clearly that a very carefully placed perimeter wall has been placed there. The earth was very carefully put around the site as if to prevent it from a collapse due to possibly a huge convulsion of the earth. So I think a lot more that's going to be coming out of that part of the world in the next few years.
What are the significance of circular patterns in ancient sites?
I think it goes back to the concept of the sacred circle, where even today, if we go out into the West and we want to set our troubles aside, we create a little fire in the campsite, and we sit around the circle like a big protective membrane. I think it's a psychological thing that really harks back to the nature of matter itself, you know, the nucleus of the molecule and the atom, where everything revolves around circles and spheres. And within that circle and the sphere, of course, is the basic pattern of life, which, of course, is the tetrahedron. And we tend to sort of either do things in circular form as a protective membrane, but also in terms of tetrahedrons, because it relates to the Holy Trinity. And also the tetrahedron is essentially God's glue, which holds all molecules together. And those seem to be the two predominant facets of any structure around the world. I mean, we look at the construction industry today, everything is built upon tetrahedrons. When you look at the beams on your ceiling, everything is held together in triangles, because that gives you strength to the structure. And I think the circle really evolved out of that understanding of watching and observing life. And also, it's a most convenient way to also pack a lot of information inside the circle. So, for example, if you're trying to pack a geometry of six spheres and a seventh in an economical way, you'll find that you'll actually fit that into a circle very neatly, just as you would do with 12 spheres around the 13th. And, of course, from that we get the fables of the avatar, like Jesus and the 12 disciples, and the stories of the King Arthur and the 12 knights at the round table, Jason and the Argonauts. These are sort of archetypal symbols, which are, again, all based on the observation of nature. And if you look at the temples that evolved out of stone circles, you'll find that they're all based on sacred geometry, which is itself a distillation of the observation of nature yet again. If you look at, for example, how so many temples associated with fertility or creativity are based on the pentagram, this makes perfect sense, because the pentagram, of course, is the geometry that subtends the spiral of life upon which all natural organisms are based. So no wonder the pentagram is so pervasive in temples around the world, which are associated with feminine and creative principles. And also it finds our way into our vernacular. I mean, there's five-star hotels and five-star generals and things like that. So you can see how these series of correspondences based on the observation of life then find their way into temple building process, which then transforms and transfers itself into people that enter these sites.
Hmm. Wow, so it's a part of us, maybe a part of our nature, to seek out these geometries.
Oh, I think so. It was all about when I began to look at temples much more in detail, and again, you have to sort of give up your life to go and do this, and it's not a subject that you can just dip your toe in. You have to literally immerse your entire body into it and just give up life and go with it. And the more you observe, the more you realize that there was a plan, and it was all about correspondence. If you take most ancient sacred sites in the world, it'll become very obvious that they were, A, trying to mimic the positions of certain stars in the universe, because when they looked at the stars, they realized that everything's based on energy, which is a very modern way of how science looks at life. It's not about chemistry, it's about energy. So the ancestors looked at the stars and said, well, there are certain constellations which exude a certain force. So if we mirror that on the landscape, for example, the pyramids of Giza are a wonderful example of a mirror and a correspondence to the constellation of Orion. And they figure that if you build these temples according to certain correspondences, which are either in the sky or also on the ground in terms of geometrical matrices, that whenever the human body is diseased with its environment and it's feeling out of sorts, the idea was that if you build your temple according to the perfect rhythms of nature, you walk into certain temples, and you will receive that perfection, and that perfection will eventually infuse itself into the initiate who goes and interplays with these supposedly innate stone buildings. And of course they're not. They're living, breathing organisms. They are alive with the energy of the site. So the idea was that you walk in completely disheveled and you walk out as a holy person with a W in front of that word. It was all about reunifying the body into a perfect environment that would allow you to remember that you also are a god. You know, you are a very divine being. You're not just a mortal structure that is born and then goes and dies, 70, 80 years later. There is part of you which is connected to a much bigger universal wide web. And it's when we forget these things that we go to these special places, and the places remind us of who we are, either by, visions, words, or just by the nature of you being very still in these places, which reminds you that you are connected to something much finer. And it's through that reception and that information that you basically, become part of the bigger picture.
Well, now, you talk about crop circles. Do those have a connection to these sacred sites?
Oh, very much so. In fact, when after I began to look at the physical evidence behind the crop circles and defining that humans are definitely not responsible for this, first of all, because there's no physical imprint that's actually been made on the crop. I mean, these bent plants have been laid down without any physical implement. They're actually hovering just above the soil. So if you and I went out with a piece of wood or a garden roller and tried to create this in wheat, of course, you'd flatten and crush the plants. And that's not what is happening. So that was the first inclination that there was something else going on here. Once we've established that there are certain scientific protocols which define that there's an energy form that's actually interacting with cereal crop around the world, the next observation was that they always appear next to ancient sacred sites. In 29 countries, and even here in America, we had a crop circle that appeared right beside the Serpent Mound in Ohio. And in fact, it also aligned on the same magnetic line that runs through the egg in the serpent's mouth. Same thing was happening in Britain as well, where we get 75% of the world's crop circles, that not only were they just sort of referencing the local sacred sites, either visually or through metaphor, through the history of the actual sacred site itself, through the symbolism of the sacred site, but also by sharing the same energy lines that run through the sites itself. So there was definitely a connection, as if they were trying to actually point something out. And when people began to write in about their experiences in the crop circles, how they were seeing energy lines, how they were experiencing certain altered states of reality, and at least 800 cases of people being healed inside them. And I should point out that a lot of these people actually didn't go there to be healed. I mean, they were actually very skeptical. They thought it was just a bunch of drunken kids that went out with a piece of wood. So when they start talking about being healed after suffering from arthritis for 15 years by entering a field of pressed crop, you've got to wonder what's going on.
We'll be right back with Freddie Silva. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Let's continue our conversation with Freddie Silva.
So when they start talking about being healed after suffering from arthritis for 15 years by entering a field of pressed crop, you've got to wonder what's going on. Well, the sacred sites also have the same rich history of altered states of awareness and healing as well. And when we put one and one together and looked at some of the information that had been found over the years from taking measurements at stone circles, in that they have certain ultrasonic frequencies that appear usually at the crack of dawn when the sun crops over the horizon, the stones do emit ultrasonic signals. Well, I found that the same thing happens in the crop circles as well, and it seems to shut off and switch on at certain times of the day because it actually interferes with electronic equipment, as the BBC have found on various occasions when they keep losing very expensive video cameras the moment they cross the perimeter of the crop circles. And that's what really, where the penny really dropped, that not only were they linking to the local sacred sites, they're actually speaking to them. And this is where at the point where you have to start looking at the long-term history of the sacred sites. If you start observing how the sites were basically available to everybody all the way up to about 2500 BC, And after that, society began to collapse. I mean, the last 4,000 years, we've seen a definite move from the divine feminine to the solar, male-dominated society, and also the demonization of nature, I should say, in a very long period, span of time. We began to see a lot of sites being shut down deliberately by the caretakers because they realized that these places of power can be used for the greater good of people, but they can also be abused for the power of a single individual. And you see a lot of sites like the Great Pyramids and the giant graves in England also being shut down with enormous stones. I mean, we're talking about 150-ton rocks placed at the entrance, deliberately shutting them down, also energetically shutting them down. And suddenly, in the latter part of the 20th century, we see the crop circles appearing beside the ancient sacred sites on the same energy lines. And suddenly, you're also seeing a huge interest, a sudden rise in interest in ancient sacred sites and people wanting to visit them, as if they almost intuitively feel that something has woken up. And I believe, after, you know, witnessing and doing the evidence on the ground, that something has triggered these ancient sacred sites to be open again, because the crop circles are also appearing on the same magnetic lines of the Earth's energy. So if they are imprinting a form of energy onto these magnetic strips like cassette tape, and I hope everybody that's listening is old enough to remember cassettes. It's a very old 20th century technology. If they're imprinting a kind of song on the Earth's magnetic lines of energy, perhaps they are just waking up the old sacred sites, and they're slowly luring us back into these temples, which were built originally also as an insurance policy for our greater good. I think there's something to that theory.
Do crop circles and sacred sites have a connection potentially to extraterrestrials?
Yes and no. It really depends on your understanding and your perception of extraterrestrial. Most people's perception is of physical beings, which are either extremely tall, little gray annoying things, or little green men. I tend to see the bigger picture. I tend to sense extraterrestrial life as also ethereal, as in beings who are very physical on their level of reality as we are on ours, but imperceptible to our range of hearing and vision, because, as you know, we're very limited as human beings. We can only hear between 20 hertz and 20 kilohertz. Animals can have a much greater sense of perception than we do. And visually, the highest portion that we can perceive of anything is white light. Yet beyond that, there are ranges of light that exist that we just cannot perceive. So if you sort of hold to that theory, which actually is a very scientific theory, and then let's assume that humans are 88 FM on the radio scale, because the atoms that make up our body vibrate at a certain frequency, which, you know, gives us the illusion that our world is very material. But if you slide your dial all the way up to 500 FM, there's a whole bunch of other frequencies and life forms available on those levels of frequency, but we can't perceive them. And once in a while, they'll sort of try to lower their range of frequency to a point where we can see them. And this is where the phenomenon of the beams of light that we see coming down and making crop circles in less than 15 seconds, which have been filmed and have also been witnessed by military personnel over the last 120 years. This is where the origin of these lights come from, and also the little balls of light and the orbs that are seen flying and moving around the landscape between temples, usually in England and also in North America. This is where the extraterrestrial phenomenon really comes in, because these little orbs and flying little things are actually a form of consciousness which descends from its level of reality to a way where it can slow down its rate of frequency so that we can actually perceive them. And of course, they're not physical at all. They're just ethereal. They're just bundles of energy. And they slow down their rate of frequency to a point where we can just perceive them as light forms. And this is where we start getting our myths of, you know, fairies and will-o'-the-wisp and little gnomes and things. It's our way of describing these incredible visions. And believe me, once you've seen these things, as I have, and I used to be very skeptical about this, so when you actually see these things on the landscape flying around in the most incredible color, and you can actually interact with them, they can literally read your thoughts, and they do things a split second before you actually tell them to. And they also have a very nasty sense of humor as well. They're very puckish. you can begin to understand that we are being connected and contacted with another level of reality, which is very concerned about the way that we're doing things down here. And I think that's what part of the crop circles are about. It's a sort of a help that we've been given. We've been told that there's an interaction going on with other levels of reality and other forms of life, which are sending us useful information to get us to understand that not only are we connected to something much greater, but also there is actual information encoded in these symbols which are very useful to us.
Now, when you talk about orbs, are these in some way connected to the orbs people get in photographs at haunted sites, or is this totally different?
I think there might be a connection. Originally, when I was asked to look into orbs, I was actually not really very interested. It was so far away from my usual line of work, I didn't really have the time for it. But I began to get a lot of orbs in my camera, too. And I'm a professional photographer by trade, and I could not explain why this should be so. Now, this was happening pretty much at the time when we began to switch over to digital cameras. Although I was aware that there are people that I know and I'm friendly with who are very intuitive people, they are great psychics, their energy field, of course, is, you know, very, very open, and they could almost produce this stuff at will in old film equipment, and it always amazed me how they could do that. But when the subject of orbs suddenly popped up, and I began to get orbs in my camera at certain locations, and I looked back at my notes and my state of being when I went to these places, and I began to put one and one together and realized that they were only happening under certain conditions. So when I went to Egypt on a trip, I was very conscious of actually being aware of my surroundings, my relationship with the surroundings, and also noted whenever that whenever I got orbs in my camera, it was only because of my interaction with the sacred site, as in I would have a certain relationship to the place, spirit of place, because there are many beautiful temples in Egypt, but not all of them really connect with you, and vice versa. And when I was at one of the pyramids, and also at the temple of Edfu, which and Luxor, which are three of my most personal sacred places where I feel very much at home, that's where I got the biggest amount of orbs on the camera. But more so when I was standing on the magnetic hotspots of those temples, which I know very well. So I did an experiment at Luxor. I know the energy fields of that site very intimately. I know where there's no energy at all and where it tends to congregate. So I was with a couple of other people who were very interested to follow on the experiment. And I literally walked down the magnetic line that runs through the corridor of the main temple. And I found that the closer I got to the altar, the more pronounced the orbs appeared on film. So when I got to the altar, I began to actually move to the right of the magnetic line, literally step by step, taking pictures as I went. And you can see is that as I get to the actual edge of the energy line, the orbs start diminishing. And there's a point where I cross onto the onto what I call profane space, and there's no orbs. But the moment I take a step to the left and go back into the energy line, the orbs are back. And it made me wonder that there's a connection between the orbs and the and magnetic hotspots, because I was getting the same thing, and people are getting the same things in crop circles as well, which, of course, are highly magnetic, and the same things in churches. If you go to the altars, those are the magnetic hotspots of the building, and people are getting them there. So I did a conscious experiment where I would go to the Temple of Dendera, which also exhibited a lot of orbs, and there was a point where I was getting these pictures at the altar, and it was literally, it looked like someone had just sent dandruff into the whole building. I mean, you could barely see what was going on. And there was one point after about 20 pictures where I just literally just said, you know, do you mind just moving out of the camera, because there are people in my family who don't really appreciate this, and I just want a normal picture. And the next picture I shot, there's not a single orb. And then the next photograph, I said, okay, you can come back now, and the picture and the orbs are back. And it suddenly made me realize that not only are these things connected to magnetism, but they're conscious.
We'll be right back with more with Freddie Silva on Reflections. You're listening to Reflections, the wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Let's continue our conversation with Freddie Silva.
Now, I spoke to this with Marcel Ledwith, who's the acknowledged expert on orbs, and he said that the ability to capture the orbs on camera really depends on the infrared filtration of the equipment, because they operate on the infrared spectrum. and the really high-end cameras have so much filtration that they cannot capture orbs. And he's absolutely right, because when I got a high-end Nikon, I can't get orbs on this camera, so I'm going to have to go back on eBay and probably get my old Canon back. I had this little cheap Canon, which is a very, very good camera, and I was getting orbs in that all the time. And again, the filtration on that cheaper camera is a lot less, and you get able to perceive that veil. So he's absolutely right. Now, when I connected with a friend of mine in England who's a renowned channeler and a trans medium who has the respect of the local police force, and I asked her about this, because I said, what exactly am I connecting with here? Because obviously I can interact with them. It's not just about interacting with the magnetic field. It's also the fact that I can talk to these things. And they seem to be conscious. They seem to be aware of what I want and what I don't want. And she said, well, it's what you're doing is that you're capturing the spirit of the actual environment, the spirit of place. It's as if the actual equipment is able to actually pierce the veil between worlds in the infrared spectrum, and it brings back the soul of whatever is actually there. So no wonder you can interact with them. But the same thing happens with people as well. When you and I photograph someone that we love very much on camera, you don't have to be standing on an energy hotspot. You and the person on the other side of the camera are energy hotspots because we are magnetic beings. So then that answered for me also the question why people get photographs of their best friends with orbs all around them. Mm-hmm. Because of that magnetic attraction between people, and that gets caught on camera as well.
This is a lot of great information, and it's too bad we can't cover more, but you are speaking at the ARE in Virginia Beach at the UFO conference on November 13th. Now, what will you be covering there?
All that we've just discussed.
Wow. And I know it's a big presentation, so it should be really interesting.
Oh, there's usually about 120 images in all my presentations. And you can always tell anyone's been to one of my lectures because they're the ones that leaving the room like deer caught in the headlight. Mm-hmm. Their eyes are very wide open, and they tend to bump into things for the first hour. I tend to go overboard on the information, but because it's fun, you know, we are so in need of good, solid information to back up stuff that we already know and perceive. We just need the sort of a little bit of the science behind it to really sort of ram it home. So that when you go to a dinner party and someone asks you, "So, what about those silly orbs?" Well, now you can explain to people in very rational terms what it's about, and believe me, they have a hard time trying to debunk that information.
Oh yes. It's really interesting how you provide the science and structure behind these things that we observe.
It's hard work. I mean, and it's always been funny though. I mean, you look at how NASA a few years ago announced to the world that, and I quote, "Every 9 minutes, portals of magnetic energy open between the Earth and the Sun." And if you read the Skanda Purana, which was written at least 10,000 BC and possibly way before that, they also talk about the serpents that move along the surface of the earth and are mirrored and fly through the sky. So the Tamil culture, even before the flood, already knew about these magnetic portals which flow all around the landscape, on which we've built thousands of temples around the world. And these things are connected magnetically, not just to the sun, but possibly to every other solar body in the universe. So they knew that this was happening. And science has this wonderful ability to, you know, take its time debunking and laughing at all of this esoteric material. Mm-hmm. And yet, when they develop the right equipment, they are able to validate the ancestors and things that we know very intuitively. So it's a bit of a joke, even though it's frustrating that you have to spend so much time looking for this hard science to back up what we already understand and feel. This stuff that the ancestors knew thousands of years ago is being validated, and we're now using it.
Well, where can people learn more online? What's your website?
Oh, I have a couple of websites, but the main one is invisibletemple.com, and you will be there for days, I guarantee it.
Invisibletemple.com. And thanks for coming on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure. And I'll see you all in Virginia Beach.
Oh, yes, in just a few weeks. It's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day will be read by Kimberly Rose, who has a CD out called Connecting to Your Higher Self. Well, hello.
Hello.
And what is today's Thought for the Day?
Today's Thought for the Day is reading 10893. Know that no influence surpasses the will of the entity. Make that will then one with that, which is the entity's ideal. And I love that because there's nothing that is influenced outside your own will. We all have our own free will. And to me, this is about trusting also that other people, that everything that people do, and that we need to respect our own self, and always when we are living in that connection with oneness and we are truly, truly understanding our connection to God, we too can live that. And they say, thy will be done. It's like in the Lord's Prayer. I think the will has a lot to do with that spiritual part of each of us.
Oh, yes. When Jesus was praying in the garden and under all that stress, he prayed for the ordeal he was going to go through to pass from him if it could. But he said, your will be done. And even though we might be going through something that we know is going to be horrible and want to choose another path, if that's the path we're supposed to go on, we should accept that God's will is right, because yes, it's not like God is going to do the wrong thing. It's good to ask, you know, it's just like asking your parents, you know, I'd like that candy bar. But if that's the fifth candy bar you have that day, then that would be the wrong thing. And they would say no. And you have to accept sometimes we want things that would not be good for us. And we have to hand that over to God and hand our requests over to him with that caveat, your will be done, because
yes,
our requests may not be right all the time.
And that takes a lot of faith. And it's so important.
It's so hard to hand it. Yeah, it's difficult to hand it over to someone else when you think, oh, I know what I want. I know what I need.
And I can do it better for them. I can make sure that it gets done right and they won't have to worry. But then we're really not practicing what Edgar Cayce really wanted us to practice. And Jesus also asked us to practice. It's about oneness. I mean, if we're truly honoring ourselves and the people around us, then we honor that they also have a role in everything.
Oh, yes. All right. Well, thanks for doing the Thought for the Day today.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks to Freddie Silva for talking to us. Thanks also to Kimberly Rose for the Thought for the Day. And most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce.